The Science Inside Podcast.
This is The Science Inside with Elna.
Welcome indeed to The Science Inside. My name is Elna Schütz, and I am your favorite nerd who spends every Monday night 1 hour looking into science of news stories and just generally our lives. And this week, it's about that local movie that has caused quite a bit of stir. I'm sure you've heard all about it. It's called Inkheba, or The Wound, for those of us that struggle a little bit with those clicks. If you haven't heard, the movie is centered around a gay love story on the mountain. Kolani is a factory worker who goes home to the Eastern Cape to help oversee the initiation processes on the mountain. One of the young Xhosa initiates discovers his homosexuality, and he is trying to keep it hidden very much, and this is where the whole story sort of comes from. It's done very well for itself, this movie. 9 awards at 44 festivals across the globe, and it's won numerous local award nominations. I'm sure you've heard all about it, not only because of the content, but because of the very strong reactions to this movie. The cast has gotten death threats. Cinemas across the Eastern Cape and elsewhere were forced to cancel screenings of the film because of protests. The movie's producers have filed a complaint to the Human Rights Commission, but then, you know, the Congress of Traditional Leaders of South Africa was supporting the protests. There are people on either side of this. Most of the criticism, of course, is around the portrayal of initiation and the Xhosa culture in general. Others have said that the critics are actually just homophobic and it's not about culture. Whatever you might think of it, one thing is undeniable. The movie has started some strong conversations. Here on the show, we love jumping into those conversations and saying, hey, you know what? Let's look at the science. Let's look at the medicine. Let's look at what is happening behind all of these conversations. So that's exactly what we're going to do in our story later on in the show today. We're looking at male medical circumcision. It's something that you've probably heard a lot about. Maybe you think you know whether you are male or female. I'm sure we can all learn something from our interview later in the show. Then we have Unscience. And we have the ultimate cure for FOMO. Yes, science has found a way for you to be at class or a party and in your bed at the same time. How great does that sound? That's in Unscience later. Then we feature a scientist. That one's going to get really interesting. And before all of that, we'll kick it off with the news just like every week. If you want to interact with us, maybe tell us what you thought of the movie, whether you've seen the movie. But most of all, I would love to hear your views on the medical side of male circumcision. Do you think that it's a great idea? Would you encourage your friends or your brother or your sister? Not your sister, of course, but people in your environment, would you encourage people to find out more about male circumcision and even do it themselves? What do you think? Let us know, as we are The Science Inside on Facebook. We have a WhatsApp line. It's 084-078-4912. And on Twitter, as always, at VowFM, hashtag Science Inside. But before all of that, we're going to get into the news.
This week, Science Headlines.
So every single week we kick off the show just by giving you some updates about what's been happening in the world of science and research. And today I'm joined by our producer, Bridget LePere. Hi, Bridget.
Hi, Elna. How are you?
I'm great. And I have a very interesting story for you.
Mm-hmm.
So the oldest complete skeleton in Britain has been revealed, at least what the skeleton looks like, or would have looked like possibly, has been revealed for the very first time by UCL and Natural History Museum researchers. It is about 10,000 years old, and there are some surprises here. Bridget, this person has been nicknamed the Cheddar Man. What would you expect this oldest British citizen that we've found to look like?
I'd assume he looks yellow with hints of green. Yeah. He looks like cheese, I mean.
Yeah, if he's called cheddar, he must be yellow, right?
Sure.
Not quite. Even if you weren't thinking along the lines of Bridget, it's still a little bit surprising for a lot of people because apparently the Cheddar Man had dark-colored curly hair and dark-to-black skin pigmentation but blue eyes, which is not a match that we might naturally think of as British. And up till now, many people have assumed that the skeleton had much lighter skin, especially in light of what you might think of as a typically British person, traditionally. But this shows that the idea of lighter skin as a Northern European thing is much more recent than we might think. And this was one of the most challenging human DNA projects to this date, because no British individual this old has ever had their genome sequenced. So the Natural History Museum really had quite something on their hands.
Wow, this is amazing. So what else do you know about this Cheddar Man?
Well, we do not know if he liked cheese or not, but we know that he is genetically similar to other Europeans of the time whose DNA have been analyzed thus far. His ancestors were hunter-gatherers that most likely moved into Europe at the end of the last ice age, and today it's suspected that around 10% of indigenous British ancestry can be linked back to that very population.
Wow, this is very cool. Is this a new skeleton?
Actually, it's not. You would think so, but the evidence is new, not Cheddar Man himself. He was found over 100 years ago in a cave at Cheddar Gorge in Somerset, which is, of course, where he gets his name from. So that's quite a long time that scientists have been trying to understand more about him and, you know, other humans that lived at the time. And now, thanks to this very cutting-edge technology of DNA and facial reconstruction, we see for the first time the face of this man that lived 300 generations ago. And if you want to have a peek, just look at our social media. We have a picture there for you.
Wow, this is really fascinating, Alna. So they got all of this information, all this DNA from a skeleton.
Yep. And thankfully with DNA, you don't need, you know, buckets and buckets of things. If you think of the movies and, you know, some spy steals, a lip print from somebody's glass, you really don't need that much to get somebody's DNA. So all they had to do was get a few milligrams of his bone powder, and they drilled a tiny 2 millimeter wide hole into his ancient skull. And thankfully, the cool conditions of the cave that he was found in means his DNA was unusually well preserved, and they were able to find out enough to tell not just some of his genetic characteristics, but do a facial reconstruction. So I think the story is so amazing, because just looking at that picture, it looks so different to what you and I not only expect, but maybe are used to. And for me, it really reminds me that the history of humans is so much more complex than black and white and what people, you know, might think, Northern European or African or American. Science is so much more complex, and in the end we're all human, even if our nickname is Cheddar Man. What do you have for us, Bridget?
Well, in this week's news story, scientists have succeeded in growing the first human egg in a lab.
Okay, so we obviously know that you can fertilize eggs, but growing them from scratch?
Yep, so this is done through they harvest some ovarian stem cells, and then from there they can reproduce an egg and grow it in a lab, and yeah, they've done it.
Okay, so this is the first time it's been done on humans.
Yes, this is the first time it's been done on humans, but they've previously carried out this this kind of procedure on mice before, but never with human eggs.
Okay, so growing them, I can understand. We've grown all kinds of different cells, but will they work the way they should?
Well, you know, it's still unclear whether the eggs will be healthy enough and normal to carry through the whole procedure of fertilizing the eggs with sperms. But, yeah, there are possibilities. And, however, a stem cell biologist, Carl Orwig, who was not involved in this study, says this is a great breakthrough and it is beneficial for patients who might need this in future.
Okay, so is this just for women who are struggling with infertility, or who is this for?
No, it's not for that only. It's women who have been who have undergone chemotherapy. It's girls who have not reached puberty as yet, so they may harvest the ovarian tissue at a stage before they start chemotherapy, and then they may use the tissue at a later stage when the child is mature enough to be a woman and carry a child, and they use the very same tissue to reproduce.
That sounds amazing, if that's possible. But it also sounds a little bit risky.
Yeah, it is quite risky because people are, when you do retransplant the tissue back into the human body, it poses dangers of reintroducing the cancerous cells as well.
That makes sense, because in the end it is still you and your cells. But are there any other problems around this?
Well, there are some other scientists who are a bit concerned, because usually in the human body it takes about 5 months to produce an egg and for it to grow naturally. But with these scientists, they've grown the eggs over 22 days only. So sometimes scientists are concerned that this could result in abnormal cells and they could not carry out, reproduce healthy children in future.
I suppose we can only really know once these studies progress to another level. What is the future like with this?
They are working on improving the process with hopes of fertilizing the eggs at a later stage with sperm, but they have to obviously get some approval from the people that they work with, so they're not ready yet to reproduce a pregnancy, but this is really groundbreaking work.
Okay, so for now they're just studying it, but who knows, in future people who had no chance of having a baby could, and their egg was actually grown in a lab.
True.
That sounds crazy. I'm always so surprised by our news stories of just how every single day we are getting further with science, we are learning new things, and it's really incredible because it changes people's lives. This isn't just some study. This might be the answer to some person who now thinks they'll never get children. How exciting is that? That was our news. But up next, to snip or not to snip, we get into the medical side of male circumcision.
This is The Science Inside with Elna.
It is indeed. My name is Elna Schutz and welcome to the show. Remember, you can find us on Facebook as The Science Inside. Tweet us at ViofM using the hashtag Science Inside. Remember, we are asking you today about your opinions about medical male circumcision. What do you think about it? And if you have any interesting questions, now is the moment. And we are having these conversations because of all the talk that has started around the movie Impeba, and it really is sparking a lot of questions around culture, but I want to bring it more to the medical side so that whatever your personal choice is, you know what science is saying. It's always important to just keep that in the conversation. On the line with us now is General Practitioner Dr. Thabani Nkwanyana. Thank you so much for joining us.
Elna Schutz and your listeners, good evening. Interesting times indeed.
It's so exciting to have you with us and to talk about this topic and to be able to talk about it so openly, because it can really affect a lot of people's lives. Let's get into the conversation just by understanding a little bit, what do we know? What numbers or statistics are out there about men who get circumcised in South Africa, whatever form that might take, both culturally or medically?
Okay, I think where we can start is actually just to try and highlight that this is a science basically targeted for kind of a resource-limited settings, that is to say maybe the third world, where perhaps there's a limited access to healthcare, or where maybe there might be limited access to condom use. So the World Health Organization then identified particularly the eastern and southern African countries where the HIV is rife, because they realized that those countries, because they are third world, they didn't really have access to many choices of preventing HIV. So there is many other forms of preventing HIV that are well established, like condoms. But if you take this to our settings, we are facing a situation where even access to condoms might be challenged. So that's why this medical male circumcision is very important in our setting. And when it started, or well, when it was found out that actually circumcision can reduce HIV to by about 60%, then the WHO, which is the World Health Organization, then it got involved into the research and tried to roll out this with a target of at least targeting 80% in the countries that are either in the East or Southern Africa. Then it picked up. Actually, I think it got to about 40%, which is maybe about 11 million people. But with time, with the antiretroviral therapy also becoming effective, and with increased access to antiretroviral therapy, then it sort of took a dip towards the end of 2015, coming towards now. So there's been it's not been picking up as was initially expected, but we understand that is perhaps because of many other things that are happening. Because fighting HIV is a lot of effort. It takes many other measures, which medical male circumcision is just one part of. Yeah.
And I hear that what you're talking about is this very concerted effort by the World Health Organization to roll this out, but how wide do you think is the awareness of ordinary South Africans, wherever they might live, about male circumcision and its benefits and why they would want to do this?
Okay, so what is actually just new is the concept that is now what is called your voluntary medical male circumcision. But if you look at the countries that we're talking about, circumcision per se, I would say it's always been there, but maybe for different reasons, for cultural and for religious reasons, really. But it is only in the recent years that it's actually been incorporated into the HIV, because like I was saying that in the year 2000, that's when the World Health Organization actually discovered that in men that were circumcised, there was kind of a reduction in the HIV transmission. So the circumcision as a practice, I would say it's wide. In most of societies it is there. In other societies it has fallen off and is needing to be revived. If we are to target the HIV concept, but it is been there. And again, my challenge will just be to say, for instance, in the provinces like Eastern Cape, where it is done almost with all teenagers each year, whether the target is actually to do it for the HIV purposes or is it just to continue the culture. So that's where the integration needs to happen, to maybe be on the same page, because it is performed, but maybe not in a context of the HIV.
I have heard so many misconceptions around that link between circumcision and HIV. Some people seem to think that once you're circumcised, you're basically protected for life. Obviously the science doesn't fully support that. Can you tell us a bit more about what the science really does say about this link, and also getting into the medical nitty-gritty of why does circumcision have such a big effect on your risk of HIV?
Okay, so I think, again, we can put it, we can flip the coin, because what we say is that it reduces HIV transmission by 60%. So if you were to flip the coin, which means you actually still have 40% of getting the HIV infection. So, and then somebody will be very skeptical about medical circumcision being the solution. If you're actually looking at that, it's almost close to 50-50. So what the circumcision really does is that if you're thinking of the penis as a component, it's got the foreskin, which underneath it harbors these cells, which are called macrophages, which tend to have an affinity towards the HIV antigens, which is the viral material that HIV brings to try and attach to the cells. So those macrophages are in the softer part of the internal part of the foreskin. So, but if you think of a penis as it is, you still have the glans, which is the head of the penis, which is also quite soft, and you still have the opening, which is the urethra, where it can also provide access. If you think then what circumcision can do, really, all it does is going to remove the foreskin, which is the covering, and help with, so all it does really is that once you remove the skin, the softer part of the penis gets hardened, which means the medical term is that it gets keratinized. So it gets hardened in that then is impenetrable. It becomes very hard for any viruses to penetrate that. But then there still are components of the penis. There's nothing really that has been identified that can prevent fluids or any HIV infection getting into the urethra or attaching into other places. And also, for instance, once you've got maybe, say, another sexually transmitted infection, like cuts or sores and ulcers, it will also still just bring in the access by the HIV. So that's why then if you think of that 60% we're talking about, is really just parts of the penis that you can do something about. But really the number one prevention is this, at this stage as we talk about it, is really your condoms, which forms a barrier, complete barrier, covering the penis from the head to the shaft all the way, which is then more of a barrier that prevents totally. There is problems also where the condom is not 100%, but it's closest. So if you think of that, then if the people understand why circumcision helps to protect, they will also know actually why then it cannot be used alone as a preventative mechanism.
That's fascinating, yeah. Because it really is you are making the chance or the area that can receive the virus smaller, and with it your chances, but that doesn't mean you're bringing it down to zero. And I thought you explained that really well. But surely this is not the only medical benefit. Are there other things we should know?
Okay, so again, that's why I was saying that this is very important in a resource-limited setting, a third world, so to speak, because then we're in circumstances where there's poor hygiene and that there's also maybe a risk of other co-infections, say, either your syphilis or your other viruses, like human papillomaviruses, then the penis tends to harbor those, either some of the germs, if there's poor hygiene, or if somebody has got other infections, it tends to harbor those, which means then if you think about the human papillomaviruses, those are the viruses that can cause cancer. So it can cause a penile cancer, and also it can be transmitted to a female and cause a cervical cancer. And one other component that is important also here is that the medical male circumcision actually, the unfortunate part is that it only protects the male. So it prevents a female to male transmission and not the other way around. So that's another important factor that people need to know. So in this case, if a female has infections or maybe is HIV positive, they may not transfer the virus to the male if they are medically circumcised, But the other way around, if a male is HIV positive, they can actually still easily transfer or transmit the virus to the female. So that's a very important information, because people shouldn't think that maybe it's just a two-way stream. It's actually kind of a one-way stream, which actually means for most females, you cannot rely on the fact that your partner is circumcised. Actually, you have to do more than that.
And what about the timing? Because if we look at different cultures, such as the Jewish culture that traditionally circumcises babies, and then many African cultures that traditionally circumcise teenagers, and perhaps some Western countries where adults might get circumcised, does it matter when this happens?
Yes, it does matter. The early infant circumcision is common, especially you talk about the Jewish culture. It is common. It raises a lot of ethical questions, which we'll not get into now, because the drive currently is about the voluntary medical male circumcision, which means it must be an adult over 18 who gives consent that they want to do it. So, which means in the other way, it's early infants and younger people, there's a lot of ethical issues. But to answer your question, the timing is important in that if you are obviously circumcised early in your life, this keratinization of the tissue that happens, which means that hardening of your glands of the penis and the skin around there, will have been there for longer, which means your skin, your softer parts of the penis will have been exposed for longer, which make them harder and harder and harder over time, which then in adults, that might already present with a missed opportunity. When you do it, say you're already older, maybe you've already been exposed, or that the hardening of the penis maybe now is not going to be as quick for you not to contract any HIV, because I mean, the 6 weeks you wait for after the circumcision is just for healing, but the hardening of the penis takes time. So the timing is important, which is why then I guess in our setting it becomes an emergency to say we have to try and reach out to as many people as possible, but then it is highly recommended that they don't use just medical circumcision as the only tool. It's very imperative and actually very important that they still use the condoms with it.
And we know that no medical procedure comes without risks. Something can always go wrong. Are there risks that men should be aware of?
Okay, so I will say there are big risks. Some people may call them maybe softer risks, because with the early infant circumcision, chances are the penis has not even developed yet, or the foreskin has not developed yet. So you are removing the healthy foreskin, and the person going older may actually think that they now do not have a foreskin. So actually another foreskin as they grow up can actually grow, because it had not fully developed. But that's one part. Then the other part with adults, which can also happen even with the younger people, this is a foreskin is what carries all the nerve endings that are important in a sexual intercourse. So that's why I was saying that this is perhaps what is seen as a softer tissue, but for most other men, if it goes wrong, it can render them to have sexual problems, particularly because the foreskin carries millions and millions of nerve endings, which means the penis can become insensitive, and also with other people, depending on what kind of clothing you wear, there's a lot of rubbing into the penis, which can cause a lot of discomfort, maybe for men for a long time, and the penis tends to be quite sensitive, which means it might just affect you in terms of, say, maybe your family, your sexual life. But again, I guess the target current is that the HIV is perhaps bigger. But for some people, maybe that is more important, that actually their sexual health is also preserved. So So the main side effect is really that you're killing the nerves or taking the nerve endings away. You're lucky if there's some left, but you actually may not perhaps enjoy to the same level the sex that you would with the foreskin.
Now that we've spoken through some of the benefits, the medical benefits, and also the risks, what are your overall views about whether this is something that most men should consider?
Well, I really think that if there's a, there will be maybe a certain kind of man, if your lifestyle, you know, how you carry your lifestyle, and you're not really worried about getting into many sexual contacts with people that maybe you don't know their HIV status. I don't, unless if really your foreskin is a problem, and that you've got some, because there can be some medical conditions that affect the foreskin, I wouldn't say it's something that needs to be removed routinely. Because it has its purpose, it has its functions, but obviously for men, or maybe where people are not sure whether they will be able to, I don't know how to put it correctly without sensationalizing it, but I think it comes down to really lifestyle and how you carry yourselves. Because if you think that maybe you're going to have many sexual contacts, and maybe with the people that you either know or not know about the HIV status, I'll say then it is something that you can go for. Or maybe if you think you're not gonna, maybe your hygiene is compromised for whatever reason, or that you think you're living a risky lifestyle that's gonna expose you to these infections. But other than that, it's really a purely healthy part of the penis, healthy tissue, that if well maintained, well cleaned, poses no problems, and if it's got no infections, poses no problems, except if maybe in a few men where you get what is called phimosis, where maybe the foreskin gets tighter and the man is unable to open it during the sexual intercourse. In that case, then it might need to be removed. But again, I'm saying this being careful, because we're in a country where there's a high prevalence of HIV. So you don't want to also send a wrong message that people shouldn't go for circumcision, because we are kind of in an emergency situation.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah.
We've been talking to Dr. Tabani Nkonyana, a very well-rounded conversation, I think, about medical male circumcision, not just looking at one side, just the benefits or just the risks, but really, really very, very well-rounded and very wholesome, I think. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
We are going to continue the show in just a second. If you missed this conversation, you just tuned in and thought, what? We are talking about male circumcision? I want to know more. Make sure that you catch our podcast. It's on journalism.co.za/science. But after the break, we continue with Unscience.
You're listening to The Science Inside, bringing you science around major news events.
Yes, welcome to the show. We transition now into the 5 minutes, the little gap in between all the science where it gets a little bit silly. It's called Unscience, and we look at some strange, some wonderful, some sometimes incredibly weird research. I am joined, as always, by our producer, Bridget LePere, just to give us a second opinion on this, but let's get into Unscience.
Unusual, unlikely, Unscience.
So I am sure you have had it. I have had it. We have probably all had that feeling on a Friday night. You're sitting at home and you're thinking, oh man, I wish I could be at that party. It's called FOMO, the fear of missing out, and it might be a party, but it also might just be a really important class or meeting that you missed and you really cannot catch up on it. It would be so great to be there without actually being there. And thanks to the science of telepresence, this is already possible, Bridget.
Well, It's like being a mini god. Omnipresence.
Well, not quite. You do still have to be awake, just somewhere else. And telepresence is a technology, any kind of technology, that makes you feel and seem present while actually being somewhere else. So the term was coined in 1980 by U.S. cognitive scientist Marvin Minsky after he read about the idea in some science fiction. Since then, a variety of research has gone into making you feel like you are there even when you're not. So the simplest version of this tech is like video calling, but with some mobility added. So maybe there's a device or a robot that has a screen attached which your face is on. So you can Skype in and maybe remotely control the robot to drive around the office, even when you're sick at home or across the country. So you'd still be able to see and contribute to all the meetings or chats around the coffee pot, even though obviously you wouldn't be drinking any coffee. So I can imagine quite a few students who would love a telepresence robot to attend early classes for them while they're still sitting in bed all snuggly. But I don't think the lecturers would quite appreciate it.
I don't think so.
So the thing is, this kind of tech has been used for some quite cool things. So there have been newborn babies that have met their dads who are away in the army, and kids who are in hospital who are able to attend school remotely that way. But if that's not enough for you, there's a new product called the Chameleon Mask, and it's taking this to a whole new level. They decided that telepresence still needs a more personal touch. So Deputy Director of the Sony Computer Science Laboratory, Jun Rekimoto, is calling it the human Uber. Like before, you are present remotely through a video link of your face, except that this time you are attached to an actual person. These so-called surrogates are walking around with, yes, a screen on their face with your face on it. They have a headset that shows them not only what is in front of them, but also signals that you give them. So maybe you lift your hand and you show them to open the door or raise their hand in class, and they'll do it.
Well, this is some form of laziness. It just takes laziness to another level.
Yeah, except for the surrogate who's walking around being you. Although, I think maybe the surrogate wouldn't appreciate everything. If you want him to hug your grandma or arm wrestle your colleague, maybe they wouldn't play along. But according to initial tests, people reacted well to this form of telepresence, and they even started treating the surrogate as if they were the person on the screen. So I'm not so convinced by that. But beyond this kind of social interaction, telepresence, believe it or not, has been quite useful when, for instance, an expert is elsewhere or, you know, not in space. Because NASA has a robot called the Robonaut that performs repairs and the like on the International Space Station. It also has a very hilarious Twitter account if you want to go look at that. But here's something else. Maybe you'd like this, Bridget. Doctors have used robots to perform surgeries remotely. Like, for instance, there was a so-called Operation Lindbergh in 2001, where a surgeon operated and removed a French lady's gallbladder, even though he himself was in New York at the time.
I don't think this would suit me very well. What if the battery dies? What if there's a power surge? What happens then?
Exactly. It is pretty scary. These cases are usually done through a virtual reality set on the one side. So you can imagine the surgeon or the engineer having his hands in sort of gloves with lots of sensors on them, and when he moves, so does the robot on the other side. And of course, usually there's a human on that side to just check that everything's okay. Not only are these robots quite expensive, you can't just buy one at home, because it costs about $1 million usually, you also, as you said, Bridget, have to be very, very sure that your internet or other kind of connection is going to be very stable. So they do make quite sure. But I don't know about you. Maybe you want to skip class, or you just dream of being able to operate on someone on the other side of the world. Maybe that's your dream. But thanks to research into telepresence, you are now able to. Unusual, unlikely, and science. So, Bridget, you're not keen for telepresence robots operating on you?
I'm not. The operating part. But maybe if it were to kiss my baby's goodnight on my behalf, maybe I might just consider it.
Okay, social robot is still okay for
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind. If it's an expert operating on me and he's just somewhere else, I'm okay. I'm okay with the robot doctor, I think.
Expert robot doctor.
That was Unscience. But next up, behind great science are some amazing people, and we want to know how they tick.
Unusual, unlikely, unscience. This is the Science Inside with Elna.
Here on the show, we love talking science, but behind science are humans, scientists who have their own story and their own passion about why they have chosen to spend their lives researching what they are researching. So it's a new thing that we're trying on the show, to really talk to the people behind the science. And today with us is Charles Mapanga. He is a 31-year-old biophotonics researcher at the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research, the CSIR. He works in the National Laser Center Unit. Welcome, Charles.
Hi, Elna. How are you doing?
I'm great. And you?
No, thank you so much. Thank you for having me, and a very good evening to everyone in studio and to your listeners.
We are so excited to have you with us. Let me just tell our listeners a little bit about you. You have been praised for your research into the use of the femtosecond laser technology as an alternative technique of administering medical drugs into HIV-1-infected cells. This laser technology is also called point-of-care, or POC, and it uses light from lasers to manipulate cells and tissues, and it's typically used for the detection and treatment of cancer, but this time it was used to look more closely, as I was saying, at HIV-infected cells and investigating whether they can be treated by the means of this point-of-care technology. And Charles and his team at the CSIR conducted research exploring the possibility of this to help alleviate the medical and economic burden of HIV in society. So it's something very exciting and something that our country needs. We were talking earlier on the show about the link between HIV and circumcision, and it just shows you again how we need all of our brightest brains on this. But Charles, before we get into your exact work, what led you into science?
You know, Elna, if I had to tell you the truth, like, normally they ask me this question, and I always talk about, you know, like, growing up in the village. It's this thing that, for me, I think I was just stuck with the love and the passion for math, for physics, and for biology. It's not like there was something outstanding that maybe I saw from someone or I saw on TV. I think just for the fact that I had so much love for math, physics, and biology, I think it's something that kept me going. And I think, you know, like growing up in the village, I mean, people always say that those are the most difficult subjects ever. And people can actually even discourage you from following those kind of subjects. But then, I mean, for me, it was a case that, I mean, since most people are believing that this thing is impossible, I mean, I can do it. I mean, if I love something, I don't need somebody to actually confirm that, okay, this is for you, that you can follow. So I just went with my heart, and I just pursued it. And as you know, they say the rest is history.
And you didn't just finish school. You actually completed matric at the age of 16, which is quite incredible, I've got to tell you, for anyone in any situation, especially growing up in not the easiest background. Tell us a little bit about what you attribute the success to.
Can I tell you the reason why I actually finished early? I grew up with a lot of cousins. I mean, I had so many cousins, and they were living in the same house. So they happened to go to school first before me. So it was that thing that you always want to come back home and try to be the teacher to the other ones that are not going to school. So they gave themselves time to actually teach me how to read and write before I could actually even start school. And I still remember very well that in the village, you know, back in the day, during like the last day of school, you'd be allowed to bring in like your siblings, your younger siblings, just to introduce them to the school. So I used to go to school with my cousins quite a lot before I could actually even start school. So when I started school in 1992, I was actually only 5 years old, and then I turned 6 during the year. So but then by that time, I actually already knew how to read and to write, like your basic things, like your mother, father, grandfather. So the other thing that happened, I think that fast-tracked me also to actually finish my matric faster, is that I did my grade 7 and 8 in 1 year. So I went to high school in July. But then I was never an A student. I think I was just a hard worker.
Well, it certainly is inspiring for those of us who, you know, just scraped through matric, perhaps. But getting a little bit more into your actual research, what sparked your discovery into just using laser technology specifically for HIV treatment?
I think for me, if there's one thing that I can tell you, Elna, is that, you know, HIV infection is something that I always say to people, that over the years, you know, as South Africans, it has become something that has affected us directly as South Africans. You know, I mean, we've lost our brothers, our sisters, our mothers, and, you know, our fathers. And given a chance or an opportunity to research on such an epidemic, I mean, the possibility of contributing to making a difference, I mean, the kind of research that we do at the CSIR, it has to be research that, I mean, is going to actually make a difference in the lives of South Africans. And then getting into this research and then feeling that I'm given an opportunity to change somebody's life with my research, I felt like I was honored with that opportunity. I mean, my research that I did, it focused primarily on the possibility of using laser technology and as an alternative drug delivery method, you know. So, but then the approach was to actually then be in the position of being able to reduce the severity of side effects of the oral intake of antiretroviral drugs. But then, you must understand that my research was still at an in vitro level. So, I mean, research transitions, but in vitro, by just doing your research in a petri dish, and then you can have in vivo, by then you're starting to do your research in, like, model organisms, like animals. But then at the early stages of an in vitro level, in my research, then I discovered that I could actually use laser technology as an alternative method to successfully introduce an HIV drug into HIV-infected cells and still be in the position of reducing the level of infection without actually even killing the cells or stressing them out.
That's incredible. Can you tell
it's amazing,
us?
Amazing, hey?
Can you tell us a little bit more about that process?
You see how the process go about is that in my case, I'm just going to break it down for you, okay? So in my case, I normally call them groups, but then in research, they normally just call them control groups. So I had HIV uninfected cells, and then I also had a group of HIV infected cells. The reason why I decided to have two groups is because the HIV-infected cells, I was infecting them in-house. So if I'm infecting the cells in-house, I need to have a control group whereby I'm going to check if my infection was successful, because I don't receive the cells infected already. I infect them in-house. So I also had two groups also, because you know the cells, the HIV-infected cells, they have that level of picking up the drugs passively without you having to induce them with the laser technology. So I decided to have two groups whereby I've got like HIV infected cells, which are not treated with the laser, and then I also had HIV infected cells, which were treated with the laser. By so doing, I wanted to check which level of infection has been reduced faster and successfully compared to the two groups. So in my case, I discovered that the laser treated cells were able to actually pick up the drug, and then the level of infection was reduced faster and at a greater intensity compared to the cells that are just infected and then being introduced with the ARV without enhancing that with the laser.
Mm. It's very exciting, the findings you've made so far. But what is the future of this technology? What could this mean for, you know, the next 10 years, even the generations after us?
I mean, this technology is applied, I mean, in different fields. I mean, for the fact that you can individually, I heard you mentioning cancer earlier on, for the fact that you can actually individually treat cells, that means that you have the possibility of, in the future, having to treat cells individually. Can you imagine in a case whereby you have a tumorous cell there, or a group of cells that are just dividing uncontrollably? And then you have the privilege of actually using laser technology. I mean, there is just so much that you can do by individually treating those cells. There is just one typical example that I can give you in that whole basket of a lot of examples. But then I think in the future, there is a lot of applications for this. I mean, in my department, one of the other things that we're looking into, which is one of our current mandates, is the use of laser technology in designing point-of-care diagnostic devices.
That is incredible, all the different possibilities.
Yeah.
But just lastly, Charles, what would you love for younger people, for students, for people who maybe don't really know that much about science or don't feel like science is for them? What do you want them to know about what you've done and also just about science in general?
You know, one thing that I can tell the young people is that it's normally something that I repeat all the time, and normally I focus it on the people that are from disadvantaged areas, because those are the people that I feel like I can relate to. There is so much that you can do in the field of science, you know? And the first thing that I always tell them is that you need to pass the matric very well. Pass the matric, like, give yourself time to study, pass the matric very well. And then there's all these people that are willing to help you out. I mean, if you're doing very well, even companies like Council for Scientific and Industrial Research, where I'm working, if you pass the matric very well, they even have, I mean, bursaries that they can give you. After passing your undergrad, they can still give you an internship position. You know, I mean, it's the thing that if you put so much work into one thing that you believe in, I always believe this in my own ideology. I always believe that if you put in so much hard work into something, there will always be people that are willing to help you out and take you a step further.
Charles, thank you so much for joining us. That was Charles Mapanga, really trying to inspire us, not just about science, but about the people behind it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Emma. Have a nice evening.
You too. We are still on the Science Inside.
This is The Science Inside with Elna.
That's the show for today, and we've had a little bit of everything. We've had unscience about, you know, FOMO and being in a place you're not because of robots. But then we also heard about male medical circumcision and both the risks and the benefits, which was a very interesting conversation. And now lastly, looking at the scientists behind the science, Mr. Charles Mapanga. And today was a really good one, I think. If you want to catch the podcast, it's on journalism.co.za/science. Big thank you to all of our guests featured on the show, including Mr. Charles Mapanga and Dr. Tabani Nkwanyana. Our team behind the scenes is, of course, production by Bridget Lepere and tech by Kutlwana Sarame. And in case you didn't know, the Science Inside is in fact recruiting. So your name could be on this list. Your voice could be on the radio. Find us on Facebook as The Science Inside or Twitter as VowFM, and just send in your contact details, send in your application, and who knows, science radio could be your next thing. The Science Inside is produced by the Wits Radio Academy, funded in part by the South African Department of Science and Technology. My name is Alna Schütz, and I will be back with you next week.
The Science Inside, Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. on OSF 88.1. We'll be right back. Listen to the Science Inside podcast on www.tourism.co.za.